Well, we have a tell you have a long lesson. I don't know if the lesson's long or not. Because it's only an hour long. I may have some slides left over. I get going in these things. You know, I make these up every week. I don't have a thing canned out, so I have to figure out what I'm going to do, and it always ends up being a lot more things we need to talk about than I expected, and that's going to be the case here again. So we're going to go up to the Scopes trial. We're going to do all the background work that leads up to it, which is probably as interesting as the trial itself. So remember these things on the board that we have over here. I'm always reminded when I put stuff on the board that we think of it as it's on the board, but it's generally an approximation of overlaps. There's many things that go on at the same time, and some things that go on that are important are not even on the board. So we're just basically talking about trends. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more later on, but we're going to talk about Greek philosophy a little bit today, and I was a little bit hesitant to do that, but I also know in my heart you don't know what it is. Correct? If I'd ask you, give me a two-sentence definition of Greek philosophy, I'd probably get a lot of silence. So we're going to do a little bit about that because it affects Christianity. And it is a former worldview that is shifting to a science worldview. And that shift goes starting around, let's say, 1600, when they start to find out, like with Copernicus, when he found out these planets rotate around the sun and what rotates around the earth, all that kind of stuff. They figure there's a motion in the stars that's predictable. And to find that there is actually gravity when the apple hit Newton on his head, or whatever. You have all these mathematical truths that are always true and without exception, always true. So science takes over. But again, it didn't happen. I've got 200-year period where that was happening, and that's my science bar. And even after science took control, science continued on, and yet it didn't for certain people, the fundamentalists, yet they were affected by science. So, that's why I say these things are approximations, and I probably need to say that to you. All right, we don't need to go over this front page. I did that last week for you. It's sort of our opener. And what the title of this lesson is From Greek to Science, the Shift of That. And I'm going to suggest that there's probably, that I'm aware of, only one other shift that has ever occurred like this in human history, and that would have been from creationism to Greek, and then from Greek to science. And that shift would have occurred when Greek started, somewhere back 500 BC, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Because I don't know what would have been before that. Before that, the ideas of science weren't there. Again, there were a lot of people that probably were pagan, but I'm talking mostly where the influence of the Jews were. They would have been strong creationists and was supplanted by Greek thought, and then Greek thought was supplanted by science. And I'll tell you that when I get to it. So we're going to wait with this till next week in terms of the trial itself. And the picture I had up there earlier, which some of you didn't see, but it was a trial, picture of the trial when it moved outside in Dayton, Tennessee. I think that's right. It was so large and it was so hot, they actually moved the trial outside. So they'd sit under the trees while these arguments were going on. Interesting that. So last week, if you give a lesson, a title last week, it was The Fundamentalists. Who are they? Where'd they come from? And they will be around, I don't want to say forever, but they now continue to be an entity. And if we are going to be identified with a group of Christians, quote Christians, we would be identified with the fundamentalists. I don't like that necessarily because it has become a pejorative. So, what's a fundamentalist? Written by somebody else. Here's an idea of what they say, and it's pretty close. Fundamentalists fought vehemently against Americans' pendulum of swing towards social liberalism by defending what they defined as the fundamentals of historic Christian teaching. One of the ways they expressed their conviction was through the publication and wide distribution of 12 books called The Fundamentals, and that's where the name comes from. The authors insisted that a conversion process must occur when inquirers place their salvation in the hands of Jesus Christ alone, and the Bible is infallible in matters of science and history, as well as theology, and following a mighty battle, which we think it's the tribulation or Armageddon, the physical return of Christ to earth will establish a kingdom where peace and righteousness will reign. So that's pretty good, I thought. And that's probably describes us. So that's why I say that if you don't fit this, you're probably not a fundamentalist. Now, one of the major causes of the rise of fundamentalism, so that there are actually a group like this, rather than in the group of Protestants, with Methodists, Presbyterians, Congregationalists together, kind of a unified group, one of the major causes of the rise of fundamentalist movement occurred with Charles Darwin on the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, published in 1859. Fundamentalist Christians preachers believe the work was a direct attack on the creation stories of the Bible, and they were right. Conservative Christian leaders became more than a little anxious with the influx of non-Protestant immigrants, translated means Catholic, arriving at the beginning of the 20th century. Later, owing to increased persecution in communist Eastern Europe and Soviet Union, and we're going to deal with that too, but not yet. We've got to wait a little bit, because that was a very, very big threat to Christians, especially the fundamentalists, because communism was considered and was an avowed atheistic government. So in response to teaching natural selection in public schools, a Tennessee law was passed. This is kind of an overview where we're going. A Tennessee law was passed, and by the way, it's very unusual in Tennessee, or in the world, in America, very unusual, but one was passed in Tennessee that prohibited teaching any evolution theory that contradicted the Bible. It's called the Butler Act because the subject of the highly criticized Scopes trial became the highly publicized Scopes trial in 1925 when agnostic ACLU attorney Clarence Darrow defended high school teacher John Scopes, fundamentalist prosecutor Williams James Bryan, you know, that is from the Bryan Hospital here in Lincoln, a former Secretary of State and a three-time presidential candidate, Democrat, argued the case against Scopes. History was made when the courts upheld Tennessee law. People don't realize that. It upheld the law and remained on the books until 1967. We sometimes think that after the Tennessee courtroom, because of what we've heard about how bad it went, that the law was overturned, and it was not. And it stayed on their books and other places for many, many years. In fact, 2 years until before Gill came, that law stayed put. So for many of those in the denominations, remember I talked about the group, the Protestants group, Methodists, Presbyterians, that group, they tended to stay with the denominations as believers in them because it was difficult to sort out which was which. Some were early adopters or rejectors, and they left, I say, around 1900. But many of them stayed on. But the Scopes trial sort of drew a line in the sand. These were now the enemies, our friends, were now attacking me. And so the exodus out of the Scopes trial, or the line drawn by the Scopes trial, was really quite helpful. Otherwise, many might have continued to linger on in the mainline churches, and still many of them did. Well, we have a group of people here. Last week, we spent an hour examining these fundamentalists, how fundamentalists were born out of the challenge of the authority to scripture posed by Schleiermacher in 1800, and he lived, basically his influence from 1800 to 1830. And again, we have long, another thing that you got to remember, that these things happen at a point in time. Like it's 1800 he wrote, and he died around 1830, and his influence really wasn't then, it was later. But his influence was great enough that it caused a reaction for the fundamentalists to organize, and they start studying the Bible for themselves. So remember the date here. It wasn't until 1919 that this organization was, I don't have the name of it here yet, I'll give it to you in a minute, was established that organized the fundamentalists as a group of men, and these are represented here. So time is slow. It takes a long time for things to change. We think something happens, it's changed, and now it's different. It's not. It goes much slower than that. Much more overlap. So how did it all start? We have a William Bell Riley, First Baptist Church in Minneapolis. Riley was the editor of the Christian Fundamentalist from this magazine from 27 to 32. In 1919, Riley founded the World Christian Fundamentalist Association. Riley was president of the Minnesota Baptist State Convention. When Riley died in 1947, Billy Graham, who Riley had chosen to succeed him as president of Northwestern, conducted the funeral service for him. Okay, so we have some names that come off this sheet. Lewis Berry Schaefer up on the right corner, I got it kind of highlighted. R.A. Torrey, Reuben Torrey is associated with Moody, remember him? That's number four. There we go. R.A. Torrey Gray is number five. He was the president of Moody. Then Riley, we already have seen him at eight. He was the founder of the association. C.I. Schofield, the reference Bible guy. So some of these guys we pick off, and I reckon some others that I don't can't tell say much about him. Rader was an evangelist, W.H. Griffith Thomas, another one, Massey, and so forth. So, but these were the people that were the fundamentalist leaders. And I didn't mark anybody off here except number 18, the bottom right-hand corner, this Charles Alexander. He was an associate with Moody, and his name was written on the Moody cabin on the fireplace. Remember that almost 10 years ago when we had that? So his name was on there, so he was part of this. He's a musician. Interesting, we talk about the Baptists or the Presbyterians and how much of this dispensationalism really pervaded. I'm not sure saying that all these people were dispensationalists, but they were all favorable to literal Bible reading. So this is 1910, the PCA of USA, General Assembly at Atlantic City, if you look, you see the ship, so right on the boardwalk. And just, there's got to be 400 people there, and these are leaders of the Presbyterian Church, you know, at a fundamentalist meeting. So there was a lot of interest, a lot of whatever representation by the fundamentalists. Now, talk a little bit about the Greek influence there. A new view, we'll repeat this from last week, then we'll develop it. A new view of nature emerged, replacing the Greek view that had dominated science for almost 2,000 years. The science became an autonomous discipline that was new, distinct from both philosophy and technology and theology, and came to be regarded as having utilitarian goals. In other words, it's void of any sectarian ideas of religion or ideas. In other words, it's an objective science. And that's what we had last week. And would you quit? And I'm going to merge this because this is what it's going to look like. All right. So get me going here. So here's the division. I said 1600, and we go up here to about 1900, but 1800 is probably fine because Darwin gets in there 1860, so 1900 would be the end of this. We have the Greek view of the world, and then we have the authority of science that prevailed, kinda, although here we had a theistic science view. In other words, they understood God was behind science. In fact, science was sort of language of God, you know, predictable, repeatable. And then we had a time, I call the seedbed, when there was some questions. Remember, Schleiermacher started to undermine the authority of Scripture, and people start not having confidence in Scripture, so they start coming with other things. And we have a couple of names here, Linnaeus and Liddell. I'll talk about them in a minute. And they become, around 1800 to 1875, going into Darwin's time. And Darwin writes his book, Origin of the Species in 1859. So now we have totally adopted science, and we have pretty well, in terms of the leading edge, pretty well rejected the Bible's influence, but it's all still science. This, you know, science has replaced the Greek view. Okay, so we have Organized Plants by Linnaeus. You know, you can see that plants are alike. And if you have noticed that, if you look at plants, they have a lot of similarities to it. The leaves are the same. They grow the same. And so there's this idea, well, maybe they're related somehow. You know, that plant used to be like this. and something happened, all of a sudden, boom, it comes out like this, you know? So that's a thought that we probably could have had. And then we have Liddell, who looked at the geology, and he saw layering and decided that the most logical conclusion that we could draw is that these layers came over years, over time, and it demonstrates long periods of time and a process towards some kind of progress. And finally, that word Unitarianism was brought up here because there is this process. So you blend these things together that people are seeing in science, making some conclusions that are wrong. But since there is a doubt about Scripture, it's easy for them to give up on Scripture and go to something else, especially the unbelieving heart. He doesn't necessarily want to believe in God for the answers to all these questions. So that's what we have. We go into from Greek world into a science world, but the science world started out pretty good. The ones I mentioned to you, they all had a high view of God. And then it came to a point where God was lost in the science view. So since the Greek to science shift is only the second shift, I'm suggesting, first was from creationism to Greek about 500 BC. By the way, that's when the Parthenon was built, those Greek buildings that some of them still stand. And it was spread widely by Alexander in his escapades in conquering the world. So we need to spend a few moments getting settled on exactly what Greek philosophy is, and I'm going to try to bring it down to a level that even I can understand, since it lingers in our Christianity, I believe. And you cannot defeat it if you cannot see it, if you can't name it, and you cannot reject it. So that's why I have a look at it. Now, interesting thing about Greek to science, and I might say Greek philosophy intended here. The safest general characterization of the European philosophy tradition is that it consists of a series of footnotes to Plato. In other words, Plato is the real Greek guy. Clear, unbroken lines of influence led from ancient Greek and Hellenistic, which is a word for Greece, philosophers to early, now notice how widespread this influence is, early Islamic philosophy, the European Christian rejection Renaissance, human thinking, remember the great statue of David, you know, that's Renaissance time, and the Age of Enlightenment, again, man is thinking himself out of his box without God. So that becomes that Hellenistic Greek thought, and Plato is the guy you start with. Now, what is philosophy? Okay, how do you say it quickly or easily? Philosophy is a form of thought that seeks to explain things encountered in life. That's pretty easy, isn't it? How do you explain things? How do you explain a tree? How do you explain weather? How do you explain evil? How do you explain good? How do you explain how we got here? All these things can be a philosophical discussion. And we may not all agree on what those answers are. But when we discuss like that, what's your opinion, what's my opinion, and your opinion, we're into philosophy, right? All right. So the attempt to explain things, their origins, and purposes is done, now here, without the aid of revealed religion or without the Bible. So you have, if it's going to be philosophy, it's not going to have the Bible in it, because the Bible in it now makes it not philosophy. Now it becomes revealed truth, not philosophical truth. Now I know I'm kind of a philosophical guy, but I like to think in philosophical terms, but they're always in terms of the Bible's philosophy. So philosophy is seen as man's attempt to explain what only God can explain. Now that is quite a big nut to crack. Philosophy attempts to explain what only God can explain. One thing they try to explain is origins. Who else but God can explain origins? But they try, all right? And they go so far as even to explain God. Man explaining God in philosophy. Well, of course. I mean, the Greeks always talked about the gods and explained who they were. And as amazing as it was, they always turned out to be like the men that were describing them. They were just had many foibles as the gods had as many foibles as the men that were describing them. So notice this juxtaposition. Man explains God, not God explains man. So there's a reversal here. Need to get away with it? Some have. So various men have attempted to posit a unified, non-contradictory system of being or thought or explanation of us. And they always want to make it suitable for all. They're not just happy to, well, that's how I think it is. I don't care what you think. No, I've got to convince you that what I think is the way everybody should think. So that's why we have these debates, or they did. Suitable for all people. And they're looking for the final one that has not yet materialized. And I say, yet, but there's hope. We're still here. Somebody's going to come up with it, and that guy is going to get the prize. Well, the poor guy down the bottom still is waiting for it. Now, some philosophical systems carry the name of their maker, like I've been using Plato. So the most influential of the long, never-ending list is Plato, and you see the dates. Now, spa, if you always have a hard time keeping track of these, go spa, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. So that way you get them in the right order. And Aristotle was the one that influenced Alexander the Great. So these are the best known Greek philosophers. There's many others. But these are the ones that usually float up first. So Plato, for some reason, becomes the king of philosophers for, I have to admit, some reason I don't know. But somehow, maybe he has the... Since you got to study all these, I don't know why his is the best. But it becomes the most popular. But apparently it represents, don't know why it's popular, but apparently it represents a plausible system for being and functioning. For some reason, he can explain something, his being and why, how, what we're here for. He does the best job of it, and most people like it. So I guess by popular demand, it's Plato. So, what did he believe? We'll have this one generally. He believed that humanity could build a harmonious society, and we use the word since the Reformation, the utopia, the no place, a just society that would be ruled by the philosopher class. Always interesting how that comes up. We just can't be all equal after all. We have to have a class of philosophers, and if the philosophers don't rule, we're going to be in trouble. So for Plato, all souls are pre-existent. I want to mention that. All souls are pre-existent, created separately. If you're going to believe in a God, they create them separately. And by the way, that word is traducianism there, if you want to know what that's called. It's been battled around. It's been rejected by Christians, and most of them, I hope. So all souls are pre-existent, not from parents. They're made by God individually. Have common and innate knowledge. They all know something in their individual creation. Since mortal souls have a prehistory, any learning is a re-education or a rediscovery of what they already know from a former life. So we get into incarnation things, you know, that kind of stuff. But to me, this is not really where Plato affects particularly Christians. Here's what it is. For Plato, there are two parallel worlds. Now, you hear that quite a bit. Parallel universes? Why is there not? Why can't you say there's not a parallel universe? Now, they may mean differently than what Plato meant here, but I'll show you what Plato meant by it. There are two parallel worlds, one evil, material, and always changing. And for Plato, a changing world is something that's evil. Because I guess when change occurs, it's usually not for the good. I don't know. You know, get older, you change, that's not good. You get old, you can't walk as fast, or you're in a limp, and I'm trying to figure this all out right now. So the older you get, the more evil the world seems because of your incapacities. The other world is perfect, and it never changes, you know, and we might even think, well, it's kind of like heaven. You know, you go there, and it's stuck. So we have this little dog here. We have the ideal form of the dog, and he's in that other world. And the dogs that are on Earth here are just a reflection of the dogs that are somewhere else perfect, and the dogs in our world are not perfect. They die, they eat each other, and do things that dogs do that you don't like, right? So the ideal is somewhere else, and these others that are in our world are there by kind of like imagination. And I got to think, across the street to the south of here, we have a church called Christian Science. And there's a lot of the stuff that they teach is like this. It comes out of philosophy, you know. This world really isn't real, you know. It's just kind of imagination, and the real world is somewhere else. Pain is imagined, you know. Well, have you ever had one? So on. But, okay, so that's kind of how it starts out. So we have this. The material world is imperfect, like a chair. Instead of a dog, you could use anything. Like a chair, whereas the ideal world, there is a perfect chair instead of the dog. The material chair is just a reflection of the true perfect chair. On Earth is a reflection of the perfect chair. The material world is the world of the body, and it changes. That's the dogs below. It expresses corruption, but in the ideal world, there is no changes. There are no changes, only daylight and a real, real world. So, the task is to escape this material world and go to a better one. In a real sense, death released them, or released the Greeks from their darkness of evil and transfers them to the light. And we have a Bible verse that says something like that. I started looking it up and I forgot to finish it. Your kingdom was from the transferred us from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light. So we have something that looks a little like Christianity. And you know what? Augustine came along and claimed it. That's where you have amillennialism. The place where he goes someplace is not this earth. It's somewhere in this third dimension, sixth dimension, far away from here, where everything is perfect, nothing changes. It's idealized on earth. It's evil. It's corrupt. We got to do away with it. In fact, it's so bad it has to be destroyed. That is a model of Greek philosophy and eschatology, and it has been around for a long time. And I'll go a little more into this. Now, unless philosophers become kings, there can be no respite from the evil, either from the state or from the human race. Now, that elitism, again, never goes away. Always somebody has to dominate somebody else, whether it's slavery or mentally captivated or whatever it is. The elite has to run the non-special people, the ordinary people. So this characteristic of political leaders, they see themselves as ruling who are enslaved. And again, it goes back to Greek philosophy. Now, here's an interesting question. Some claim that Greek philosophy, in fact, we're going to start Ecclesiastes on Sunday morning, remember? Some claim that Greek philosophy was in turn influenced by older wisdom literature, that has to be Solomon, and any mythological cosmologies of the ancient Near East. Through this, though this is debated, all right, not sure, and so you know who Charles Clough is. I listened over the years to a lot of his stuff, and he said there was somebody working on this, and he was really excited that they're going to, you know, kind of make these connections with Solomon, because how in the world, and the Greeks did have some pretty good ideas, where in the world did those guys come up with that? Well, it makes a lot of sense if they got it from Solomon, and Solomon got it from God. Now we're making some sense, but the guy died before he could finish his work. So I'm thinking there's some pointers in this direction, and here's one of these pointers in that direction. Solomon is the source of this wisdom that's corrupted in Greek mythology or Greek philosophies. Now you have over here a mosaic or a fresco actually from Pompeii, destroyed in 79 AD. We were there last summer, and they had already taken this out to somewhere else. I don't even know where it is now, but it's a fresco, and it is probably a picture of Kings, 1 Kings 3, 16 to 7, 28. Remember, Pompeii is where? What country? What?
Italy.
All right. Kind of far from Jerusalem, isn't it? Yeah. Not that long after Christ, and I would say this fresco probably was there before Christ came. I mean, these things are old. I'm not saying it was, but I would expect it. So we have here a picture of something in 1 Kings, and what these people aren't labeled, you know, like I am, so on and so forth, but we have here is a possible the earliest existing pictures of a scene from the Bible also includes the philosophers Socrates and Aristotle, which is which, I don't know, and then in the middle we have Solomon. What's the story going on here? We got a baby here. We got a Roman with a knife in his hand. Are you ahead of me? We have one claimant mother sitting here and another claimant mother sitting pleading here. You see it? So the real mother is pleading, don't kill the baby. And this mother is sitting here, so I'm just waiting for my half. And these people on the side here are horrified. This is a Bible story. In Italy, 79. So this leads you to think that the knowledge of Solomon and this wisdom was around a long, long time. All right, so maybe we're saying it's possible that this wisdom stuff actually came from Solomon. And there I have to leave that. If you want to look this up, it's on the Biblical Archaeological Review magazine, January 5th, 2017 issue. Okay, now, earlier versions of Christian and Greek philosophical syncretism are in modern times referred to as Neoplatonic. Neoplatonic. So Augustine would be a Neoplatonic guy, new, not from old. An example of this can be seen in the works of Origen. Now, Origen has come up a lot, and I always put a black hat on him. You know, he was very, very popular, and he was very much admired by people like Augustine, because Origen took the Bible allegorically. Augustine took the Bible allegorically. Augustine took the eschatology allegorically, made this kingdom somewhere in the sky somewhere. And Origen had a lot of problems because he eventually was excommunicated from the church after he was dead. I mean, he was a heretic. But the church has followed this heretic. So an example of this could be seen in the works of Origen and his teaching, by the way, about 225 AD. So an example of this can be found in the works of Origen and his teaching on the noumos, or the nous, the intuition of as to Origen, the thoughts, what you know. All souls preexisted, Origen said. Now, he is a Christian, but he says all souls preexisted with their creator in a perfect spiritual, non-material state of as mine, or nous, I don't know how to say that exactly, but later fell away, these people that were created, later fell away in order to pursue an existence independent of God. So in some sense, the fall was a group fall. They all fell together, according to Origen. Remember, he's supposed to be a Christian. Since all souls are created absolutely free, God could not simply force them to return to him. You asked about Arminianism. That's been an Arminian idea there. This was, according to Origen, due to God's boundless love, respect for his creatures. So God just respected these people to make their own decision to come back to him. Well, how's that going to happen? So that didn't happen, except for the opportunity for it to happen. Instead, God created the material cosmos and initiated history for the purpose of guiding the wayward souls back to contemplation of his infinite mind, which is, according to Origen, the perfect state. Now, this is supposed to be Christian stuff. It's Greek philosophy. And it creeps into Christianity. I asked Tommy Lice one time, it says, I've been thinking about this for quite a while. I said, well, how much of Greek philosophy has crept into Christianity? How much Hellenized Christianity do we have? Oh, lots. And I'm waiting. I need somebody to explain that to me. What do you think it is, you know? So anyway, they think there's a lot, but I think someone needs to do this work. And I've done some on eschatology. Some of you know that. The Greeks have been influencing eschatology, how the end is. Okay, so it doesn't take long. We talk about Greek philosophy generally. It doesn't take long before, now this may take hundreds of years, but I mean in terms of eternity, it doesn't take long before one's mind tires of chasing these elusive ideas, and everything coming up to a final end. Francis Schaeffer did a great job of this. The ideas just roll over each other with no end to the speculation, and the one-upmanship that occurs within the intellectual community never ends. So when an alternative view of the world emerges in the discoveries of science and mathematics, the old world of the Greek was less appealing. All right, so now we're going to go to shift to science. As the Greek and all others attempt to explain our existence, our origins, our function, the new discipline of science showed promise that it could finally settle the questions of origin and function because there was no guesswork in science. 2 + 2 = 4. The truth was objective. That is, truth is objective, means it's true for all. Thus, all would have to agree to its findings. No wiggle room here. The end of rancorous philosophical struggle would end with the true answers, moving from the uncertain emotional to the naked truth. Boy, what promise science gives us to get to the bottom of all these questions. So the scientific revolution saw the creation of the first scientific societies and the rise of Copernicanism, and the displacement of Aristotelian natural philosophy and Galen's ancient medical doctrine. I didn't write that, obviously. So, with fears of over and misrepresentation, this shift, I'm fearful, to science, it cannot be disputed that science stole the driver's seat in the 19th century as the Bible's authority, took that seat, that the Bible had, and it was loud, and because Schleiermacher discredited the Bible. If science were to offer a satisfying worldview, now the challenge is for science, if science were to offer a satisfying worldview, then it would have to answer the big questions of existence. How do we get here? What are we doing here? Where are we going? If science and mathematics can be harnessed to predict the motion of the planets, it will also have to explain the origins of it and the purposes for it, and then actually improve on religion's answer. That's what it's going to have to do. That the worlds are here by, you know, have to prove on this, that the worlds are here by divine degrees and are kept in a predictable order by a powerful God. And I submit they haven't done that. They promised they're going to do it, but they can't do it. They haven't done it. But we're still going to try, so we're still in the age of science. So we must clarify that by the time science became an alternative worldview, Greek philosophy had seriously infiltrated the Byzantine, that is the Christian era from 325, with a totally reorganized eschatology. I hinted at it with already, and I'm probably going to give that's all I'm going to give you. It was a weakened Hellenized Christianity that the scientific era encountered. Weak Christianity was susceptible to the scientific era. The authority of God was weakened by Hellenization, was easily jettisoned by, in favor of a demonstrable science. Something in a test tube is a whole lot better than having faith in God. As we said, philosophical science offered to explain origins and functions. The answer to the questions of origins, the toughest to solve, actually had no lasting influence on the biblical answer of creationism. They didn't approve on it. The Greeks suggested evolution, but it never took hold in the Christian era, especially the fundamentalists, until a weakening Hellenized Christianity was crumbling even further. That's where the mainline denominations, you know, took the bait. But the fundamentalists stood off from that. The Reformation retained a Hellenized Christianity. It retained the ideas of the Greek by its most avid spokesman, Augustine. Augustine, without a Platonic Greek philosophy, he said, I would never have come to know Christ. That's how powerful Greek philosophy was in the mind of Augustine. He claimed that it was his road to salvation. Now that is an incredible statement for someone that's a believer, and he's supposed to be a church father. That's why I call him the Juveniles. Now we get to these guys on science that started to open the door. Andrew Dixon White wrote in the History of the Warfare of Science and Theology in Christendom, 1896, Linnaeus, a Lutheran, was the most eminent naturalist of his time, a wide observer, a close thinker, but the atmosphere in which he lived and moved and had his being was saturated with biblical theology. This permeated all his thinking until he got old. Toward the end of his life, he timidly advanced the hypothesis that all the species of one genus, is that the right word? I think that's right. Constituted at the creation one species. And from the last edition of his Latin word here, System of Nature, he quietly left out the strongly orthodox statement of the fixity of each species, which he had insisted on earlier in his works. Of course, the Catholics and the Protestants both warned it. What I'm saying here is he saw these plants and he grouped them and decided they were connected. These plants had parents that didn't look like them. He starts off by some non-living and living. Well, that's a nice, you know, rocks aren't trees. So when it comes to trees, you have all these kind of, and I'm not going to go through all this, you know, cucumbers, all kinds of cucumbers, and they kind of do look like. I'm not going to tell you what plants look like. You can figure that one out. So that's what he saw. The idea that plant animals could be classified due to similarities became the foundation for the evolutionary philosophy to gain a footing. You know, it'd be as ridiculous as we would say Chevys become Cadillacs if they live long enough. You know, well, we say, well, they're the same head of the same manufacturer, but they're not ever, you know, Chevys don't have Cadillacs, or Cadillacs don't have Chevys. Did I say it wrong? So as noted, Linnaeus, there was a reaction to his mild attempt to relate plants to each other rather than see them as separate creation. Remember, Jason Lyle did that for us. He had one graph up here with the tree with branches, then another biblical is each one had their own family. Now, that's this guy saying, no, they're not individual. They're all together like this. Now we're opening the door because they had a common source. Guess what? They all relate to each other. They came, but, you know, they used to be different. There are changes in forms. So as noted in Linnaeus, there was a reaction to his mild attempt to relate plants to each other rather than see them as separate creations. By the middle of the 19th century, 1850, what had been unthinkable becomes possible with Darwin. I'll do it again. So the idea of evolution was as ancient as the pagan Greeks, but it never caught on in the Christian West as a viable explanation for origins. They had the Bible, and it explained us, you know, like we do. Well, I don't need anything else. It explains. I don't need science. They had the Bible, it explains us. What else do we need to know? But the times of late 19th century were a-changing. This time, the advances in all disciplines, theology to industry, were laced with an optimistic hope. What's another word for the optimistic hope, folks? No, the system of eschatology we studied here last week. Post-millennialism, right. Okay, I just let me think a little bit. They're laced with post-millennialism. I should have put that in there rather than optimistic hope, right? So they're expecting things to get better in man. And with this optimistic hope, man's going to solve its problems. That's, after all, what it does, post-millennialism. So this newfound confidence found new life in the ideas of progress. Evolution, as suggested by Darwin, was a big hit with the Bible skeptics, the unbelievers. Especially in the fields of science and theology, everything was explainable by the concept of the inevitable progress which harnesses nature's machine of predictable laws. You know how strong that is. If you can get, you know, if nature is like a watch, you know, and the gears are, you know, they're going to run, everything's going to be on time. Wow, there's no guesswork here. And you can have that now applied to our origins, the big questions of life. Now, remember, they're just picking up the middle. They don't worry about the end. They worry about the, you know. But if you just, you know, you get fixed on it. Wow, this is it. This is it. We just need to build out from the beginning and to the end, and we'll have the whole thing, which you never do. But, you know, there's a real attractiveness to this science idea. Now, we know about Darwin. His discoveries are recorded in his book. At age 22, a naturalist took a five-year trip around the world. He traveled, collected scientific data in 1835 on the SS Beagle. He came to the Galapagos Islands off Ecuador. There he saw remarkable creatures. We almost went to the Galapagos Islands one time with H.E. Singley. Remember him, our organist? He said, you guys want to go to the mountains of Ecuador and watch and see the, the electric generating plant for HEJB for the broadcast, or do you want to go to the Galapagos Islands? What stupid question that was. Where did we go? We didn't go to the Galapagos Islands. Should have gone there. I think the reason we didn't go there took another night, so. Well, Sandy and Bill have been there. Said they were there recently. They're not here tonight. So you might ask them about the Galapagos. All right. So he went there and studied these things. And he noticed that on these islands, there were certain birds where there were insects. I don't know why they weren't insects on other islands, but that's what he decided. And some of those had small beaks. Another island, they were finches, but they ate seeds. They had bigger beaks. And he said, aha, look at this. He concluded that they had a common ancestor and the bird that changed into to survive in different environments, a small innovation to apply this model to all living creatures and including to man. I wrote his book. Now, he is the best known of the authors of Principles of Geology of Lyell, given to before, which presented uniformitarianism, things all the same for a long period of time, anything can happen. The idea that the Earth was shaped by the same scientific process is still in operation today, he said, to the broad general public. Darwin gets the help that he needed, another independent contribution to a world without the Bible. And he says, I just finished your volume. It is a splendid case of close reasoning, and my hearty congratulations to you on your grand work. Believe me, Darwin says. Darwin's another peer review came from an atheist. The book received a glowing endorsement from another from none other than the renowned atheist Thomas Huxley. His approval was obtained more easily than Darwin expected, and he said, nothing, I think, can be better than the tone of the book. As for your doctrine, I am prepared to go to the stake for it, Huxley says. So Darwin is now in print, suggests that man descended from primitive organisms adapted to his environment. This made it possible for man to survive. He expected opposition, and he wrote about his theory, what he said. Although I am fully convinced of the truth of these views given in the volume, I by no means expect to convince experienced naturalists. Why not? Anyway, he didn't expect to, but from a point of view directly opposite of mine, it is so easy to hide, that is to show, our ignorance under such expressions as the plan of creation or unity of design. He's attacking creationism. So surprisingly to Darwin, even the scientific world quickly assimilated his model. By 1900, scientists and religious leaders known as modernists incorporated the theory into their religious teachings. And the idea of the six-day creation was persona non grata. Even the evangelicals, the dispensationalists, were subject to the prevailing winds of philosophical science, and they start building in time into their calendars. So here we have Clarence Larkin, and you notice over here we have built into time now this destroyed Earth, and then it's recreated, and that is called the gap theory. And we talked about this before. J. Vernon McGee still teaches the gap theory, even though he's dead. He's still playing his tapes on Bott. And then we have a touch of Greek in the end over here. The world is burned up like a ball of fire. That's a Greek thought. Came directly from Augustine's idea, and it has not been shed over the years. So the religious front or wave of attack grew out of the modernist denial of the early chapters of Genesis, putting creation in doubt. Darwinian evolution posed an opportunity to offer an alternative model for the origins of all living things that did not need a creator God. A silent God of sheer luck seemed more likely than a God who created and wrote plainly about it. You know, a God that says nothing and a God that can do something and wrote about it, nah, I don't want that. Why? Well, it's better to have no one than someone who may confront us. There's only so much Bible believers can give in this battle. Some wrongly had given away the young earth, certainly not all of them, but they were agreed that they were not going to give away the recent creation of Adam and Eve. Without this first couple, the entire record of the Bible collapses, falsified. Man evolved from animals was a lie of the devil, and this was the hill to die on. So they would say, large blocks of time, perhaps, but even recreation of the worlds, perhaps, but evolution is not permitted in our schools. All right, so stop the advancement of teaching evolution in the schools. They wanted to stop the advancement of teaching. Now, just aside, there probably wasn't a lot of evolutionary teaching in the schools yet. But Darwin, remember, he's been around now 75, 65 years. Remember how slow things go? You know, you think, well, they've been teaching within 20 years or 10 years. Next time a book was published. But no. But they're starting to publish a book with stuff in them about Darwin, all right? And they didn't want that to be taught now in the schools. So in 1919, we have this World Christian Fundamentalist Association was started by this Riley. He encouraged states to pass laws to protect the Christians from evolutionary teachers and textbooks. States of South Carolina, Kentucky, Florida, Texas introduced such laws. Didn't say that they were passed. In Kentucky, a law failed by one vote. Florida passed a non-binding resolution urging teachers not to teach evolution. Passed by the House and the Senate. The 1923 anti-evolutionary bills were introduced in six states. Oklahoma passed a law banning textbooks teaching evolutionary material, nothing but what was taught in the classroom. The anti-evolutionist law was not passed, the books were removed. So we have this, you know, we got to make him a John Butler the farmer. I'm sorry, farmers. I mean, you guys just always are the last guy to be considered smart. That's not true, but yeah, well, it's just a farmer. Don't like that. So John Butler, farmer, campaigned against evolution in his election. This is in Tennessee now. Representatives. Butler wrote a bill on his breakfast table at home. I can see him doing that. He said that 99 of 100 in his district believe like he did in creationism. The bill passed the Senate 24-6, the House of Representatives 75-5. You know, good margins. And the governor signed it into law, known as the Butler Act, the first state to have an anti-evolutionary law on the books. I don't know, maybe it's the only one, I don't know. The governor did not expect that it would be going to be an active statute. He didn't think anybody would challenge it. I mean, Butler said that everybody in my community or my constituents say they're creationists. They're not going to challenge this. Well, this took place on a worldly attitude change. We got the flapper dress and the roaring 20s. Life in the United States was a changing. So the enactment of the Tennessee law and seek to have the law thrown out, they, top says ACLU, active in recruitment, to have it thrown out, they needed a willing teacher to break the law and see it through. A notice appeared in the Chattanooga, Tennessee Daily. Chattanooga Daily. And this is what it says. Now, how bald-faced this is. We are looking for a Tennessee teacher who is willing to accept our services in testing this law, prohibiting the teaching of evolution in public schools, in our courts. Our lawyers think a friendly test case can be arranged without costing a teacher his or her job. Distinguished counsel have volunteered the services. All we need now is a willing client. By this test, we hope to render a real service to freedom of teaching through the country, for we do not believe the law will be sustained. I think it's a constitutional law. Well, nearby in Dayton, Tennessee, George Rapaglia, however you say his name, 31, manager of the bankrupt Cumberland Coal and Iron Company, saw the ad, bid on it. Because of his declining coal company, he was looking for ways to promote local business in the town of 1,800 that was down from 4,000. Formed in 1920, the ACLU, now 5 years later, hadn't really had a case yet, I don't think. Not a substantial one, formed in 1920, the ACLU, as a nonprofit organization whose stated mission is to defend and preserve the individual rights and liberties guaranteed to every person in this country by the Constitution and constitutional laws of the United States. Rapaglia, a Methodist, not a fundamentalist, favored evolution, went to the local Robinson drugstore to talk about a trial at Dayton that it would draw attention to their city. And it's interesting, all this stuff is photographed. There's pictures of it all the time. You know, like, this is one thing that was not done in the corner. In fact, they wanted it, the more the merrier. The druggist Robinson, also school board chairman, agrees next day, at least five others, including the superintendent and three local attorneys, to meet at the drugstore. Not agreeing on the issues involving evolution, they did agree that a trial would be good for the community. And there you got a picture of the drugstore. Now, I ask, freedom in teaching, question mark. What about the teaching kids to build a bomb? Is that freedom to teach? But which is more dangerous, bomb killing, making bombs or to bomb the soul? You know, some of bomb the soul, that's not a problem. But, oh, no, you can't make bombs. So where is this freedom going to be applied? Now, I say freedom, whose freedom? What of the students or the parents who are the legal guardians? Do they not have constitutional rights too? Here the ACLU has no regard. Why did the ACLU not take up their rights of parents against those threatening their freedom? So the ACLU has a very selective choice that they always make. And they can't always choose both sides, and they always pick the wrong side. Once in a while, they'll pick what looks like the wrong side, just to make it look good. So it's not wrong to deny freedom of some. Is it not wrong to deny freedom of some to force the ACLU's restricted ideas of origins on others? That's honorable. So we have John Scopes. It was during the summer break. Biology teacher Ferguson, normal biology teacher, refused to be involved, but a coach, John Scopes, substituted as a teacher, almost like this is all planned, for biology and received the textbooks. But the students reviewed the textbooks. They had a coach teaching biology. Now, that's kind of what I had. Our coach in our school taught me history. And guess what we learned? nothing about history. I know, that's an aside. He could not actually recall if he had taught evolution in the class. But he agreed to help with the case. It was rumored that Scope then gave some students a quick lesson in evolution before the July trial so that it could be truthfully said that he had taught them evolution. All of a sudden, really worried about the truth here. So the great English scientist in the book, I don't know if I need to read this or not. I'll just do it. Charles Darwin, just from this book that he read to the kids or taught from. Charles Darwin, from this and other evidence, explained the theory of evolution. This is the belief that simple forms of life on Earth slowly and gradually give rise to those more complex, and that thus ultimately the most complex form came into existence. His life should mean to us not so much the association of his name with the origin of species, but rather that a patient, courteous, brave gentleman who struggled with true English pluck and bravery against the odds of disease and attack of hostile critics. He gave the world a proof of the theory on which we today base the progress of our world. So he's, in a backhand way, giving Charles Darwin, you know, a red carpet. While the men in the drugstore planned their action, they sent for Scopes, who was playing tennis. Scopes' proposition hesitated. Did I really teach him evolution? Then he accepted the challenge and returned to his tennis game. Well, he went back to the office and replied to the ACLU. Dr. Scopes, J.T. Scopes, teacher of science, quote, quote, will be arrested and charged with teaching evolution, consent of superintendent of education for test case to be defended by you. Wire me collect if you wish to cooperate with the rest will follow. So that gets the LC involved, ACLU involved in a matter of time. So they replied. We have the reply. And there was a problem we didn't get scheduled because it looked like they were going to have this before a grand jury who actually sends the indictment. But the grand jury wasn't going to meet till August, and by that time they figured some other jurisdiction is going to pick up this case, and they'll be out. So they jumped it and they arrested him and put him on trial. Just everything was just so manufactured. And I did finish. There we have the end. I'm not going to go to the rest of it. We'll leave that for next week. So the trial went on, and it was a hot, what did they say, July? And in Tennessee, I imagine it's hot, and a lot of people, so they actually convened outside on a hot day. And so the trial went on underneath the trees.